This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Monday, April 25th. I'm Angela Dunning. Should the Alaska Marine Highway System be managed differently? That's a question being asked by ferry advocates as they cope with smaller budgets and reduced schedules. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the research of an expert who studied other ferry systems and the ways they're governed.
Since it began more than 50 years ago, Alaska's ferry system has been part of the State Department of Transportation. And for the past decade or so, there's been a Marine Transportation Advisory Board to provide input. But the board has no real power and is often ignored when significant decisions are made. So the Southeast Conference, a regional development group long involved in the ferries, wants to look at different methods of governance.
There's no presupposed answer to the question, how should the ferry system be run and what should it really look like?
That's Robert Venables, who's involved in the State Advisory Board and the conference's Transportation Committee. During a March meeting, he brought in John Waterhouse of Seattle-based Elliott Bay Design Group. Waterhouse researched different governance models for Washington's Transportation Department, which runs that state's ferries. He said one of the largest is British Columbia Ferries, with 35 vessels linking 47 coastal communities.
It's probably the closest thing out there to the Alaska Marine Highway System in that they have routes that are providing lifeline service to outlying communities. But they also have the advantage of routes that are basically more commuter-based or more urban-based.
BC's system used to be a crown corporation owned by the government, but operated somewhat like a business. That changed about a dozen years ago.
And the province essentially said, look, we're going to make this a private company with one shareholder, and that one shareholder is the province.
Waterhouse says some of its routes are subsidized, but others are not.
So they have tried to divide up the operation by the economic benefit to the different communities and have challenged the management of BC Ferries to try and run it as commercially viable as possible.
A very different example is the Steamship Authority, which links Martha's Vineyard, Cape Cod, and several other areas near Boston. Waterhouse says it covers its operations and capital costs from its own revenues. Taxpayers contribute no money.
What this means is that they do control their own destiny, but it comes at a very high price.
He says a short ferry ride that runs $4 per passenger in Washington State costs $10 in the waters of Massachusetts.
It is expensive to try and do this, but it's a model that gives the control of the ferry system to the community involved.
Yet another approach is the Golden Gate Ferry, which is part of California's Golden Gate Bridge, Highway, and Transportation District.
That district uses that bridge toll money to fund both a bus operation and the ferry operation to help link commuters from the north side of San Francisco Bay into the city.
It doesn't carry vehicles, since there's a bridge, but Watterson says it works.
It is a model of a system where they are part of a transportation network. They don't move a lot of people a year, but they do it fairly efficiently. And again, they control their own destiny because it's their bridge money.
For contrast, Waterson brought up the Bridgeport and Port Jefferson Steamboat Company, which is east of New York City.
They have one route, they have three boats, and the system was originally started by the showman P.T. Barnum, who was looking to link agricultural products from Long Island to supply the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
It's privately owned and operates without a subsidy, and it's been in business since 1883.
It's been a successful system for that route, but it requires a commitment by the private family or the funding source behind it to keep this ferry system operating.
Then there's New York Waterway, which runs commuter ferries and buses to and from Manhattan. It's a partnership between the private and public sectors. Waterhouse says government arranges for land and builds terminals and parking lots.
So they've turned that over to the public because that's something the public agencies can do better than a private agency can. The private part of it has come in terms of the vessels. Those are purchased by, maintained by, and operated by a private operator in the area.
New York Waterway's passenger-only ships were built by Sitka's Allen Marine. Waterhouse says they've been so successful that they're looking at expansion.
They have seen that this is a transportation model that works. They have done their own economic impact study showing what, for every dollar spent on ferry transportation, what are the benefits to the community. So the message is there. The ferries are fundamental infrastructure for the rest of the economy.
He says ferry advocates always need to be clear in their approach. They need to be able to tell their system's story and explain why it's important. And they need to focus on finances.
One of the constant themes that keeps coming out is how do you get predictability of service without getting predictability of funding? Those have to go hand in hand.
He also says Alaska's current system for input is not the best way to go.
You've got to have that dedicated oversight that has to be more than just an advisory group.
That's an argument some advisory board members have been making for years. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Petersburg's fire department has two antique fire trucks in its fleet that are being overhauled. Here's a story about one man who is volunteering his time to get the vehicles back on the road in top condition. That's what you would have heard in the 1930s if there was a fire in Petersburg. It's a hand crank siren that sits on the dash of this 1928 Model A Ford fire truck. If that didn't get your attention, there's also this golden bell that hangs behind the seat.
So when somebody was driving this truck, there would be another person at least in the front seat operating this bell by hand. And that siren.
Jack Slatt is not a firefighter, but he is an expert mechanic, and he's volunteered his skills to overhaul this Model A for Petersburg's fire department. It all started with Slatt observing a number of parades in downtown Petersburg. The Model A was in the parade, but
It ran really rough. It did not sound good. It popped and backfired, and it had no muffler. Anyway, long and short of it is I volunteered my time in what was going to be just a good complete tune-up and maybe minor overhaul turned into a major overhaul.
Now Slatt stands next to the vehicle, housed in its own room at the Scow Bay Fire Hall, just outside of town. The truck's hood is raised from the side, showing off a shiny green motor, which Slatt completely rebuilt. This fire truck is the oldest vehicle in the fire department's fleet.
You can see it had no cab. This was an open cab. So if it was raining cats and dogs, the firemen were probably already suited up in their gear anyway. So a little.
During the day, Slatt is the chief engineer for the state's ferry Malaspina. But on nights and weekends, he can often be found here tinkering with tools. In the next room over from the Model A is this other antique fire truck, a 1936 International.
This truck has a one-piece siren and a beacon up on the front. That's a pretty interesting unit. You see that?
Uh-huh. It has a big red light.
Mm-hmm.
It looks.
And it's a siren as well. So for 1936, 37, I think that was pretty advanced, pretty impressive.
The Model A took more than a year to rebuild, but things are moving a lot slower with this truck.
I think I pulled the engine out of this a good 2 years ago.
While it was easy to get parts for the Model A, the 1936 International is a different story. Slatt says they only made this type of engine for about 3 years.
I went on a wild goose chase to try and find pistons because two of them were damaged so bad there was no way that we were going to use them. I found six brand new Zollner truck pistons in a warehouse in Michigan. Standard size for that engine. So this whole thing's been a big adventure.
Slatt tried some online forums on this vehicle, but he says the people participating were mostly hobbyists who knew little about real mechanics. So he decided to go it alone and teach himself by using
two really old service manuals.
That's right. Very old books detailing the inner workings of this 1936 vehicle. Slatt was then able to find specific parts throughout the country. It's a process that he's found quite interesting.
You know, there's something very unusual about this International that I find fascinating. It's the ignition system.
Apparently, there are two kinds, a spark ignition and one called a magneto.
So that means if you're running down the road to a fire and your ignition's cuts out, which could happen with these old points distributors, you'd still have a backup and you'd make the fire. How cool is that?
Now, how much more work do you want to put into this one?
Do I want to put into it? Well, I've got a lot of other stuff to do, but I'm kind of committed.
Slat would like to have the International done by the 4th of July parade. That means getting the motor and transmission back in and the wheels back on. The local fire department has recognized his volunteer efforts by naming him an honorary member. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning. And to see photos of the truck project, you can go to our website, kfsk.org, or visit us on Facebook. The 640-acre Point McKenzie Correctional Farm that's outside of Wasilla provides food for the state's prisons and local food banks. Inmates raise pigs, cattle, and chickens and farm thousands of pounds of potatoes, tomatoes, and other produce each year. And as Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned, the farm does more than provide food and savings for the state. It helps people turn their lives around.
John McElwain walks me through his pig barn, past lounging sows with swollen teats and squealing piglets. Other little ones nap in the small wooden shed.
These ones are new. These are about 2 weeks old. She had 12. They're just kind of doing their thing in there. We build a little house for them to keep them warm, and they like that.
McElwain never envisioned himself as a pig farmer. He was working as an industrial painter, but he started using drugs and was arrested 3.5 years ago.
I hate to say it, but coming to prison was probably one of the better things that has happened to me. You know, if I'm really honest about it, I needed to be taken away from myself.
When he was living in the pretrial facility, he went through drug abuse treatment and took anger management classes. A year later, he was finally sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was sent to Goose Creek Correctional Center. Because he was minimum security, not a sex offender or an arsonist, and pretty low risk, he was given the option to live and work at the correctional farm instead of the prison. He's one of 35 inmates there. McElwain says working on the farm is keeping him focused and on track.
Sitting over there across the road, twiddling your thumbs, you're more apt to get into all the negatives that are in prison, you know, and when you're busy working or busy doing what you're doing, you're less likely to fall into those pitfalls, you know.
McElwain says it feels different being on the farm than in pretrial. He and the other men are judged by their work rather than just as inmates. They're trusted to follow the rules as if they're behind concrete walls instead of on a farm that doesn't even have fences. Unlike Goose Creek, which has over 200 security officers, Point McKenzie only has 4. Lieutenant John Gindling helps oversee both institutions.
So they learn responsibility out here. That's one of the big things, too. And a work ethic, because they are just like you and me. They go to work every day. They get up. They go to meetings. They tell us what issues are going on.
Most of what's going on is massive food production. The 3.5 million pounds of vegetables, eggs, beef, and pork are sent to correctional institutions across the state, saving the department more than $500,000 in food costs. Last year, the farm donated 174,000 pounds of produce to the Food Bank of Alaska, too. Most of the meat stays at nearby prisons after it's butchered by Joe Harvey in a meat locker a few buildings away from the Red Pig Barn.
Right here, we're taking the baby back ribs off. This is the loin roast. So what we do is we follow the bone, because this is all your baby backs right here. We'll have to trim this off right here because this is the spine.
Just like McElwain, Harvey never pictured himself on a farm or working as a butcher. He says when he was first arrested 24 years ago, he didn't care much about improving his future. He was 18 and had been involved in a burglary that led to a death. It wasn't until he spoke with the parents of murdered children that he started to fully understand how his actions impacted others. He decided to focus on being a better person. Harvey arrived at Point McKenzie in 2013. He says his work in the meat locker and in the fields harvesting vegetables shows him that his contributions matter.
We feed the other prisoners, which they get real food, not processed, not canned. And also, because we do the donations and everything, it actually helps the community. And they have access to the fresh vegetables that we produce.
Harvey says having the freedom of the farm helps them develop healthier interactions with other inmates, too.
If you do have conflict with somebody, it's a little easier to take that step away and get the breather and then go back and say, hey, you know, I was wrong, or we need to deal with this in a better way.
But Harvey doesn't think programs like the Correctional Farm are the cure-all for reforming prisoners. And there's only anecdotal evidence to show that it reduces recidivism. DOC doesn't track rates for specific facilities. Harvey says the farm helped him focus, but it won't work for everyone.
People have to be willing to put in the effort for the programs to be effective. Some people are there, some people aren't. Some people get there by going through the program.
Farm staff gives inmates more than a few chances to get on board, but one or two are sent back to Goose Creek every year. After 3 years on the farm, Harvey doesn't plan to be one of them. He's up for parole in the fall and hopes he'll be released so he can start his own small business. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And I'm Angela Denning. This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. Thanks for listening.